Charles C. Price of the University of Pennsylvania on April 26, 1979. As I said, I'd like to start out with your childhood and see the kinds of things that might have influenced you in being a scientist and leading to your extremely active career. Reading over your various activities last night, I was exhausted just reading the number of things you've done. You were born in Passaic, New Jersey in 1913.
That's right.
And can you tell me something about your family, brothers and sisters? Where were you in line?
I was the first of five. I had three sisters and a brother. My brother became an engineer. My father was an engineer.
Oh, that's...
And there were two kinds of pressures on me, I guess. My grandfather had been an M.D., and one of my uncles was an M.D., and my grandmother was pushing me to be an M.D. But when I lost my hand at the age of six and that kind of eliminated M.D. for me, and that, I had no taste for it really anyhow. But my father was an engineer, and so my brother wound up as an engineer, and when I went to college I was going to be a chemical engineer.
Mm-hmm. So you already had those leanings?
I certainly was leaning very much to science when I was at the George School. I took all the science and math I could, and that was my favorite subject. And I had one other, my grandmother had another interesting influence on me. She was quite a remarkable woman. Her MD husband died when she had four kids to raise. And she'd never gone to college, and she built an apartment house and used the proceeds to put her kids through college. And when her youngest son was getting through at Penn State, was an All-American lacrosse player I guess a national champion heavyweight wrestler or something like that, she decided to go to school with him, and she graduated with him in biology and then came to Penn and did a master's degree in biology. And I lived a year or two with her when I was in grade school, and I went to all kinds of biological club meetings with her, so I got kind of exposed to biological science very young. So I was naturally inclined and had that much of an encouragement to go science. But the real thing that decided me to be a chemist, I think, was Jerry Creighton, the professor at Swarthmore. Quite an interesting physical chemist. He'd done a lot of electrochemistry, wrote a major textbook at that time on electrochemistry. Got the patents that Atlas has used to make reduced sugars to sorbitols and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, yeah, there's no sense in being a chem engineer at Swarthmore. You might as well study chemistry. If you don't want to be a chem engineer, you'll be a lot better chem engineer. So he steered me into chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And needless to say, I never went back to chemical engineering. I guess the other major influence in my career was Louis Fieser. Jerry Creighton had a very interesting philosophy about recommending his students to go to graduate school. He would not recommend, there were four of us who were majors in chemistry that year. Shall I shut the door? He had a principle of not recommending all of us to the same schools. As he said, then the best of you will get all the assistantships or scholarships, and the other three won't get anything. So he made us draw lots for the big three, Harvard, Princeton, Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And I drew Princeton, and the guys that drew Harvard and Yale got assistantships, and I never even heard from Princeton. And Swarthmore had this system of outside honors examiners, and Louis Fieser was my outside organic examiner.
Mm-hmm.
And he found out that I had no
assistantship
or anything to go to graduate school. This was depression, so that was fairly important.
Right.
And he apparently liked what I did for him in the organic exam and the orals. And 2 weeks later, I got an offer of a scholarship to go to Harvard that I hadn't even applied for.
Oh, hey.
So that made my decision very easy. I decided, yeah, indeed, I would go. Okay.
Right.
And, of course, I decided to work for Louis Fieser.
Mm-hmm.
And... But I
did you decide on the basis of what had happened? That is, he'd been your examiner, and Or did you actually look around when you got to Harvard?
Well, I looked a little bit, but I was very grateful to Louis Fieser
sure.
for what he'd done for me,
yeah.
and other things being equal, I was going to work for him.
I guess the other organic chemist there, Bartlett, got there about the time you did, and he
Bartlett
was very young.
Bartlett was there,
and
Kohler was there, and...
That's essentially it,
that's
I think,
it,
because
yeah.
Conant had just become
he'd
president.
Just been president. So, actually, I was kind of interested in physical chemistry approaches, and it was an interesting interview with Louis. He gave me all the synthetic organic
right.
things to do,
right.
and I said, yes, yes, what else? Yes, yes, what else? And he went through half a dozen organic synthesis problems and finally came to one on the mechanism of addition of substitution of bromine and aromatics, the phenanthrene thing, and I jumped at that.
Yeah.
Whereas that was more mechanistic, and of course in that I actually got a lot of help from Paul Bartlett, because Paul Bartlett was working on bromination
yes,
at that time. Stan Tarbell, for example,
right.
was working on the addition of bromine
right.
to substituted maleics, and so I got a lot of help from Paul Bartlett, but Louis was my supervisor, and I did a lot of synthesis to make substituted phenanthrenes to measure the effective substituents
right.
on the reaction. And Louis was in twice a day, every morning and afternoon, what's new?
That's the way he ran his research group.
He came around twice a day, morning and afternoon, and his first question, well, what's new?
My goodness. And did you feel you had to have something? I guess you did. There's a story that goes around, and maybe a legend that you'd bet Fieser that you could finish up in 2 years. Is it?
I don't know what I bet him, but I did.
I know you did. That's an absolutely incredible record.
Well, having a good honors program at Swarthmore, I had an excellent start, but I also did work pretty hard, and I had a lot of luck. You got to have luck
yeah.
in research to get have things fall in place,
yeah.
but it all did fall very well.
Let's go back, and then I'll come back to that yeah. period, because that's the period I want to concentrate on. But tell me a little bit about your father's influence on you and growing up, and I guess you grew up in Passaic.
My mother and father lived there in an apartment only the first year or two they were married.
I see.
Mm-hmm. But we did live in North Jersey all the time I was young.
Mm-hmm.
They moved to Elizabeth shortly after that, then to Summit, and then to... My father then was had great ambitions. He was a hard-driving, entrepreneurial type. He wanted to make $1 million by the time he was 30 years old, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He started his own engineering company in New York, T.W. Price Engineering Company, with offices in the Woolworth Building, downtown New York. And he designed and supervised the building of steel plants during World War I, and he designed and supervised the building of one of the coaling stations in the Panama Canal.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite a successful engineer. And he was, I guess, making a lot of money. But he worked so hard that he had a nervous breakdown, or physical and nervous breakdown. About the time I was 4 or 5 years old, I guess, and the doctors told him he had to quit this hard-driving entrepreneur company of his. So he bought a farm, a 200-acre farm near New Brunswick, New Jersey, so he could get out and get his health back again. And he farmed. He had a 40 or 50 dairy cattle and distributed milk every morning in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and did do him a lot of good, but farming was not his bit. And about a year and a half after he started that, the barns all burned down on Sunday afternoon, just after they put all the hay. They suspect it was spontaneous combustion. And so that essentially got him out of the farm business, and he went back to being an entrepreneur and started the biggest dog kennel in the U.S., the Strongheart Kennels. He sold dogs to Gallicurchi and Cal Coolidge and all kinds of other people. He had highly trained, hired a German,
mm-hmm.
trained his dogs, bought dogs from Germany, mostly German Shepherd. And he made a fair success out of that, and then he got back into the engineering business eventually on his own inventions. He had some inventions related to improving coal burning furnaces in homes that were very good. They really were excellent. But he got into that business just about the time oil was becoming the way to heat homes, and so that didn't go too well. But that's the kind of father I had. He was a very dedicated, hardworking kind of a guy with an engineering background from Penn. He did his engineering degree here in Pennsylvania.
So your hardworking life is sort of natural to you, I guess.
I guess the Quaker tradition is sort of in that way too. Both my mother and father were Quaker from mm-hmm. Quaker families.
That's true. Louis Hammett mentioned the fact that you were out at Notre Dame, and he always wondered how a Quaker marriage got.
Yeah, a peaceful Philadelphia cake Quaker right up in the midst of the fighting Irish. Yeah.
Right. This grandmother that you spoke of, was this on your father's side?
That was my mother.
Your mother's side of the family. What kind of a role did your mother play in the family?
She was very much a housewife and a mother. She didn't have a lot of what I'd call outside activities. She was interested in things. She was no intellectual. After she, in her later life, she became actively interested in a number of causes, like the World Federalists and other things like that. But she had five children to raise on a farm. When the first time I really became aware of things was when we were living on the farm, and she had not only her own kids to take care of, but there were quite a few farm workers that came in from time to time. And we had regular, at least one family that lived in a little house on the farm that did a lot of the extra labor on the farm. It was a big farm, 200 acres, fairly active one. So she had a pretty busy life, and of course Dad kept her stepping pretty well. He was always off with some extracurricular activity in his business.
What about your own schooling? You mentioned a school there at one point.
I went to public school until through primary and secondary school, local schools in New Brunswick and Bannockburn. Mm-hmm. We lived about halfway between Bannockburn and New Brunswick. We used to take a school bus to school. But I guess I was always the exploratory type, getting myself into all kinds of things, and I guess I got on my father's nerves quite a bit. Like painting the family car one day, and just a lot of little things. I guess I was pretty hard on my father, not intentionally. I just was always into something. I always had my own ideas of what I ought to be doing, and relatively few inhibitions about them. And so when I was in eighth grade, they sent me to live with my grandmother in Swarthmore. And I went to eighth grade at Swarthmore High School. And that's when I got so well acquainted with my grandmother, living in that apartment house of hers in Swarthmore. Mm-hmm. And then after I finished eighth grade at Swarthmore High School, they sent me to the George School, which is a Quaker school in Bucks County, boarding school. Mm-hmm. And the first year I kind of goofed off quite a bit there and got into all kinds of trouble because I was an absent-minded professor even then. I'd forget, things that came once a week, I was always forgetting to go to. Things that came every day, I can remember, but things that came once a week, like assemblies and things, I'd just plain forget them and wouldn't go to them. Half the time when my family came to pick me up, take me home for a vacation, I was out there walking off hours of detention, which was what you got if you didn't do things you were supposed to do at school. So I was... I wasn't one of the hell-raising type. There were those kids at school. I just didn't quite managed to do the things I was supposed to do when I was supposed to do them always. And the first year I had problems with English and Latin and things like that. I didn't like it all. But I eventually graduated there with a pretty good record. I think I had nothing but A's in science and math courses.
Anyway,
that was a good school.
Any particular teachers who influenced you at that particular books that you remember? Teachers and books, I guess.
Well, Norman Swain, I remember, was our chemistry teacher, and I did enjoy chemistry there very much. I liked astronomy. Some astronomy taught to us there, and one of the teachers was an amateur astronomer, had his own little telescope, would go out and look at the stars, and I was always intrigued by astronomy. And of course, I'm still writing books about the last book I wrote has a lot to do with the origin of the universe, and cosmic theory and whatnot. So I've retained an active interest, an amateur interest in astronomy. But I did, that was kindled there at George School. And I've always been very actively interested in sports. I'm a very active competitor. Vigorous competitive instinct, I'm afraid. It still hasn't been completely subdued. So I did a lot of sports. I played baseball and football and wrestled at school. And then when I went to college, I transferred the baseball to lacrosse, which was the world's greatest game, in my opinion. So
that's an Eastern game. I come out of the Midwest. We just don't know.
It's spreading all over the country now. But in your time, it was only played here on the East Coast. That's absolutely right.
I take it you expected to go to college at a fairly early age.
I had no question about the fact that I would go to college. I think there was great doubts in my parents' minds as to whether I ought to go to graduate school. I didn't get any encouragement. It took Jerry Creighton. Visited my father in Plainfield and told him that they ought to let me go to graduate school. My father had a business at that time, and I'd spent my summers working in the business, and he just thought, you know, it would be very nice if I went into the business.
Right.
I don't think Jerry Creighton had a great deal of difficulty in convincing him, but it was kind of interesting that Jerry Creighton came over to Plainfield to visit with my father to persuade him that I ought to go to graduate school.
He obviously had a fair amount of faith in you. Did you, before going to Swarthmore, did you consider other institutions? Or
Almost not at all. My father graduated from Penn, but he spent a year at Swarthmore when he was 15, and he goofed off that first year, and his father took him out of school because he flunked a couple of courses, made him work for a couple of years, and then he finished at Penn. My mother spent 1 year at Swarthmore and then married my father. So they both had been at Swarthmore. A lot of the family had gone there, and I guess I never even considered going anywhere but Swarthmore.
So it was a family thing. Aside from the science, which obviously you've got a lot of support there, can you tell me anything else about undergraduate life at Swarthmore?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. One of the highlights, of course, was meeting my wife. She was 2 years behind, and I met her when she was a freshman. And I guess it wasn't much more than a month after we met each other until we decided that we were going to be for each other. And one reason I had to get through Harvard in 2 years was so I could marry her as soon as she graduated from college.
I see.
Those were the days you couldn't get married when you were in college. In fact, I would have lost my scholarship at Harvard if I got married. Back in those days.
There was that kind of stipulation.
It was a stipulation. You couldn't, I guess the theory was that you'd be diverted away from all those evenings in the lab. And so you couldn't get married and keep your scholarship and fellowship at Harvard. So that was a very important facet of my life at college. She's a wonderful gal. And life with her has been very inspirational, and she's played a very important role in.
Okay, well, that was one very important thing
that happened at college. I enjoyed sports. I was lousy at football. And why I played football at George School and college, I'll never know. I would have loved playing soccer. I loved to run. And that's what I loved about lacrosse. I played the midfield and ran all over. I was really handicapped at football with one hand, and I would have been an advantage in soccer. Not to have hands to hit the ball. And why I was so stupid to keep on playing football instead of soccer, I don't know. But I did play football in the fall. Never really enjoyed it, but I loved lacrosse. I played that. I didn't do any winter sports in college.
When did you pick up the squash?
When I went to Harvard. Hadn't intended to play squash, but one of the guys was Stan Tarbell, I guess it was, that got me started playing squash. He had a squash game with somebody else, and that somebody else couldn't play, and so he came around and says, come on down, I'll show you how to play squash. And when I left the court, I went and bought a racket. That was a great game. But I think Stan was the guy that got me started. We were good friends at Harvard and did a lot of things together. I guess it was Stan that got me started. But I didn't play any squash. It's worth more. There were no courts there. Mm-hmm. They have them now. So sports was very important there, and the other thing that was very important in Swarthmore was the honors program. That last 2 years of honors work, just a stupendous way to learn for people who know what they want to do.
What did it consist of?
Well, you have two seminars a semester. They were advanced physics and organic chemistry, or advanced math and physical chemistry. I mean, I just took, every semester I took an advanced chemistry seminar, and there was either an advanced math or an advanced physics seminar to go with it. And you met once a week for 3 hours or so with a prof, and you had a lot of independent, in our organic seminar, for example, the second semester, or first semester we went through Conant's book from end to end and did a lot of extra reading. The second semester we wrote a paper every week, each of us, and each week one of us would talk about what he'd written about. I mean, we'd have to do, and we had our, the honor students had a little desk in the back room of the library, and we sat there with Beilstein and everything all around, and chem abstracts around us, and we literally dove into the literature, and we did papers on the Grignard or the Friedel-Crafts or you name it. We had to write one paper, about a 20-page paper every week, plus a whole day in the lab. We spent one day in the lab, a lot of time on independent reading and study, and it was just a fantastic way to study. And plus the fact that you were sitting with three other guys who were doing the same kind of thing, you had a lot of mutual education, you know, whatever any one of us learned, why we'd share with the others, and like it is in the lab when you're in graduate school. I've always said you learn more from your lab partners than you do from the professors. And I said that when I'm a professor.
I think it's true.
Very true. But that kind of a experience of living together, and we did live together, literally, because we were there almost every night working, and it was just a tremendous experience.
Do you remember the other fellows who were there?
Sure.
And what became of them?
Charlie Stauffer was the guy that drew Harvard. He went to Harvard. And
I think Stan Tarbell mentioned him to me.
Stan and Charlie were lab mates. No, they weren't. No.
Well, was he the fellow who started with Bartlett and then switched to someone else?
Switched to Kiste.
That's right. Yeah.
He started with Bartlett.
He did a year with Bartlett.
And then he went over, and he's since done a lot of work for the International Critical Tables. He's been one of the people that's done a lot of compiling and editing and that. He's been in academic work ever since he left Harvard. He was in Worcester, was it, for a long time. Now he's at one of the colleges up in Maine, or he may have just retired. Johnny Brode drew Yale, and John went on to work for Procter & Gamble, and is very successful at Procter & Gamble. I think he's a vice president or research director or something like that. John has been at Procter & Gamble. Now, Dave Brearley, the fourth, was not as nearly as good a student as the other three of us. Mm-hmm. I think he didn't make it to honors, actually. He did it, but I think he didn't pass all his exams. He graduated in course. And he went to Harvard and got a master's degree at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And then worked for DuPont and a few other companies, and I kind of lost track of Dave, really.
Okay. And these are obviously the people you were... Do you remember anyone else who was particularly close to you at that time, who either became a chemist or who didn't? Not it. If there was somebody right off the top of your head, I'd say fine, otherwise don't...
Nothing very spectacular. I still have a lot of good friends that I made from La Crosse. Mm-hmm. Some of those fellows I still see quite frequently. I was a fraternity member there. I don't see too much of my old fraternity mates. I never was a gung-ho fraternity type.
Okay. So, you were, certainly during the last couple of years, you were pretty much submerged in your science studies. Who was the organic professor at that time?
Ed Cox, Fred H. Cox. He had a hand in inventing, what's this red, not mercurochrome, the other, hexyl resorcinol. Mm-hmm. That was his specialty. He made it by that rearrangement of an ester to put with aluminum chloride. I've forgotten the name of that reaction.
Oh, okay.
Where phenyl ester rearranges to a hydroxy ketone,
yes,
and then you reduce the ketone and put the hexyl group in that way.
Okay.
So he had a hand in developing that for a few years in industry. And then came to Swarthmore and spent the rest of his life as a professor at Swarthmore. Very interesting little, cocky little guy, about 5 feet five, a little martinet, but interesting. He became the U.S. science attaché in Paris. He always had a close affiliation with the French organic chemists.
Mm-hmm.
Loved them, spoke French fluently. But he was a good professor. He wasn't, I don't think, the same caliber man as Creighton. Creighton was a really great man, very bright, mm-hmm. The kind of man you had a great deal of respect for. Ed Cox, you worked hard for because he demanded it, but he didn't have quite...
He was the fellow who was demanding all these papers, I take it.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That's right. And he was a good influence on me, no question about it.
Any other people, any other professors there were particularly influential, or again, books that you remember specifically? Obviously.
Yeah, I think there was another very important influence at Swarthmore. I think the excellent math I got was math and physics made it very easy for me, even though I was an organic chemist, to do things mathematically.
Yeah, right.
To not be afraid of looking at physics and physical principles, and help influence me to be a physical organic rather than an organic. In fact, I could have easily become a physical chemist.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd gone to Princeton, I'm sure I would have been a physical chemist.
Yes.
Incidentally, I did finally get an offer from Princeton about August, a little too late. So I could have easily wound up going. If I hadn't been for Louis Fieser, I would have gone to Princeton, and I'm almost certain I would have been a physical chemist if
mm-hmm.
I'd gone there, because they had some very good physical
mm-hmm.
chemists, and that was their forte. And that was my inclination. It was only Louis Fieser that dragged me away from it, in a sense, to get me to be an organic chemist.
These are little-known tales that only through this kind of thing will ever be known to the community, which is nice.
But the other thing that was that I remember very much from Swarthmore, I think was pretty important in my education, were the courses I took in the history and philosophy of science. Very fascinating courses. They made a big impression on me, and I think they broadened my look at science much more than than I think a lot of scientists who take a fairly narrow view of what they're doing. And, a fellow named Holmes, how was his name? Well, I always called him Ducky Holmes. Of course, had a formal name. I mean, he was delighted to be called Ducky Holmes. He'd run for Congress and all kinds of things. A fascinating guy. And Bran Blanchard taught the philosophy of science course. And those were very interesting, fascinating courses. We read books about the origin of the universe and evolution and all kinds of things like that. Holmes was a fascinating teacher, and so was Bran Blanchard.
Let me, before I go too far,